The Week in Art is sponsored by Christie's. Visit christies.com to find out more about the world's leading auction house since 1766. Auction, private sales, online, art, anytime. Hello, it's The Week in Art. I'm Ben Luke. This week, as Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are sworn in as the President and Vice President of the United States, what might their administration do for the visual arts? As well as talking to Jory Finkel about Biden and Harris, we'll talk about QAnon, the far-right conspiracy theory that became a terrorist organisation, and how its origins may lie in the activities of a collective of radical Italian artists in the 1990s. And in this week's Work of the Week, we actually look at 20 works, Alphonse Mucha's Slav epic, with Mucha's grandson, John. Before all that, it's your last chance to take advantage of the Art Newspaper's January sale. Save 30% when you purchase a digital subscription before the end of January. The subscription includes full access to our website and iOS app for iPhone and iPad. The promo code is WAX121. That's WAX121. Now, last year we looked at the effect of President Trump on the art world, but now that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been sworn in as US President and Vice President, we thought we'd look at the future. With the ravages of the coronavirus pandemic and a divided nation, what role could culture play as the US heals and rebuilds after Donald Trump, or seeks harm to none and harmony for all, as Amanda Gorman put it in her stunning poem at the inauguration? I asked Jory Finkel, a contributor to the art newspaper based in Los Angeles, how central she thinks the arts will be in the Biden era. Jory, before we start talking about sort of possible policies, should we talk a little bit about the personalities? What do we know about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's personal taste and commitment to the art?
President Biden has had such a long history serving this country that we know just about everything there is to know about him. We know which Bruce Springsteen songs he likes, for example. He likes James Joyce and Yeats. He reads poetry. He's read poetry. He said it helped him with his stutter as a kid. So he has some connection to literature. We haven't seen him involved in a direct or personal way with that many museums or arts organizations in the U.S. He's been busy. Vice President Harris, and it is fun to say those words, has been involved with the arts in her life, in particular with music. She's very musical. She grew up playing first, I think, the flute and then the French horn, and the kettle drums as well. And by the time she was in high school, she was really involved in a couple of dance troupes that used to go out and dance at local community centers and senior centers. One was called Midnight Magic.
So we know that they are arts involved, at least, you know, within the field of the arts. But let's begin talking now about what we think, you know, particularly the visual arts need from this administration, because we're in, you know, a situation of unprecedented crisis. There was this committee, right, on the arts and humanities that resigned en masse under Trump. So basically, after Charlottesville, the terrible events in Charlottesville with the white supremacist rally, this committee resigned, right? Can you say, do you know much about that committee and what role it plays?
So that's the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities, and it's really an advisory committee. So it's played different roles in different administrations, but this is the first time that it's fallen apart almost completely, where, you know, it became dysfunctional because of Trump's actions as president. In fact, a number of people resigned before his inauguration. So it was already hobbled by that, just by his coming onto the scene. And then the remaining private sector members, Chuck Close was one of them, resigned after Charlottesville. Charlottesville being the site of that white supremacist rally where President Trump said there are quote unquote good people on both sides. The remaining members who were in the private sector resigned at that after that event. And then Trump said, oh, no, I'm dismantling it. And one of the members had to tweet something like, very funny, you can't break up with me. We already broke up with you.
Okay. So, it would seem certain, therefore, that that might be reinstated, that committee, right?
that would be a very easy and natural decision to make, just to show support of the arts and to have some formal mechanism for bringing some advisors into the White House.
Right. So one of the intriguing things for me is that I hadn't really got my head around before now is that, of course, in Europe, there are culture ministries, there are departments of culture right across governments. But in the US, there is no culture department. Is that right?
Correct. We don't have a cabinet level position. We don't have a culture czar, so to speak. And there have been some calls for it recently among art critics here, which I think you can understand during a pandemic, during an economic crisis, you would like some formal way to make sure the arts don't get shortchanged and don't slip through the cracks completely. On the other hand, that's not how funding in America works. So if we did have an arts czar, they wouldn't have a lot of money to fund anything. So it doesn't quite make sense. I mean, the most powerful organization at the federal level is probably the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. And those are organizations that Trump kept on threatening to dismantle, to defund. Every year he would say, we're going to defund the NEA, like we were back in the 1980s. But instead, bipartisan support in Congress kept the NEA funding alive. And so they just got $167 million budget. And that's all money that gets redistributed, right, to smaller arts organizations.
Right. So, I mean, I suppose also if you were to create a Ministry of Culture to have a cabinet level position, that's a costly endeavor. You'd have to find a building for it. I mean, one sense is that it would also be very expensive to create that, right?
Yeah, very expensive. And what's the goal? What's more exciting to me is to hear a lot of talk these days about creating a possible WPA-style program, putting artists to work. You know, famously, it was FDR who did it as part of his New Deal in the 1930s. It was one of the later parts of the New Deal that he put the artists to work. You know, we all know the stories about Jackson Pollock painting murals. You know, so there were post office murals and school murals and gym murals, lots of murals, other works projects as well. But I'm seeing a lot of talk about that, and that is something that makes sense to me. That, you know, should we be asking right now what the Biden-Harris administration can do for the arts, or should we be asking how can the arts be used to advance the agendas and priorities that he's already stated are top of his list? We saw in the inauguration what he named as top of his list. It's the public health crisis. 400,000 Americans dead from COVID, the economic fallout from that, the environmental catastrophe of our own making, and also the racial justice crisis in America, the convulsions we've been going through. And that's, to me, I don't know if anyone else has talked about this, but I feel like that may have the most potential. Is there a way for artists to get involved to help on issues of racial justice? These are the issues that artists care about so much. Can they be hired in some ways? You know, when we think about racial justice initiatives, it might be structural changes in the incarceration system. It might be structural changes in the police departments. But is there a way for artists to get involved in those kinds of big projects? That would be absolutely fascinating, I think.
And of course, In doing that, you are able to give artists work when we are facing this terrible crisis among artists at the moment, where we hear that self-employed workers in the States are suffering more than they are in other parts of the world, for instance. There don't seem to be as many safety nets for self-employed people. And of course, the overwhelming majority of artists are self-employed.
You are absolutely right. It is the lack of safety nets. So artists here are struggling. You know, we have all different kinds of figures, but there are some reports that in certain fields, performing arts, for example, that over 50% unemployment rates have affected those fields.
Do you sense that there is capacity within Congress to have that imagination about what something like the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, can do? Because it seems to me that we are in very different times. We have been through culture wars. We're sort of in the middle of a culture war right now. Are we going to be in a situation where Congress is going to approve such an imaginative and actually, frankly, costly process?
Well, I think there are a couple things going for us. You know, one is that there is a precedent for this, both at the federal level in terms of the WPA works, but also New York State during the recession of the 70s had a really interesting program. And California's governor, Gavin Newsom, has created something already called the California Creative Corps and earmarked $15 million in his new budget for that. And that's a WPA-style program. And the second thing we have going for us is that this is a time of radical rebuilding, I believe. It's not build back, it's build back better. We know that so many systems have either been decimated by the pandemic or exposed as frail and racist and dysfunctional by the pandemic. So I think there is pressure to be imaginative these days.
Right. Now, there's also this talk about if you can't have a department of culture, is it possible to have a sort of position in the White House, somebody of influence effectively in the White House that has the president's ear and the vice president's ear and can advocate for the arts in amongst all the other departments? Is that a possibility, do you think?
I think so, but I think that's what the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities is meant to do. You know, I wouldn't mind having a culture czar of sorts or cultural advisor of sorts. I think it would be interesting, but I also think it would be largely symbolic.
Right, yeah. So the key thing is that we see practical measures, right? And I think that's the thing, isn't it? That's what President Biden is under pressure to do, because he's saying he needs to get the economy back running. He needs to get people out there and doing things. And I think that's what we'll need to see in the cultural sphere, right?
Yes, but that's where we're going to see the big policy changes, right? In terms of the economy, maybe in terms of transportation. We now have Pete Buttigieg as our transportation secretary. Those are where we're going to see the big policy changes. And I think the question is, can the arts be integrated into those more? For me, that's what I'm looking to see. The other thing I'm looking to see is just how the fact that President Biden and Vice President Harris, the fact that they're more culturally curious, culturally engaged, how does that change the White House? I mean, if you think back to the Obama administration, some of the most exciting arts initiatives out of his administration were not big policies. They were just individual choices that he organized, that spoken word poetry event, I think it was back in 2009, and invited a little known composer, Lin-Manuel Miranda, to present a work in progress. And Lin-Manuel Miranda later said that if it had bombed, Hamilton wouldn't exist. That this is where Hamilton made its debut, at a White House event. And then later we saw what the Obamas choosing Amy Sherald and Kehinde Wiley for their presidential portraits, what effect that had on Amy Sherald's career. It was tremendous. I even think back to that as maybe the beginning of the moment that we're in today, where we see this enormous popularity of Black portrait painting. You can say that started then and there with the Obama's choice of Amy Sherald as their portrait painter, or from Michelle Obama. So I think these small decisions have really big consequences in the culture, and that's what we're going to see a lot more of as well.
Right. And then, interestingly, there's this story that's emerged about a painting by a 19th century African-American artist being chosen by the Bidens, which is a really interesting thing because, apart from anything else, I wasn't aware that in this 19th century group of painters, the Hudson River School, the American Sublime and all that, which is so connected to white settler mythology, that there were very, very skilled and powerful African-American artists. And so to see this work by Robert Duncanson, which is called Landscape with a Rainbow, which is borrowed from the Smithsonian, brought into the Capitol by the Bidens, it seems to me that, again, that they're setting an agenda here. They're saying, let's not just talk about contemporary culture, but that let's also look backwards. Let's look to the past and see where there might be gaps there and fill them in too.
Absolutely. I think that was a really important signal to us that it's not just contemporary Black culture, that's going to become part of this White House, that we are going to be looking to the past. The painting was made in 1859. So how interesting is that? And he was an abolitionist, Robert Duncanson. I don't know much about him. I mean, even that, the fact that, you know, they're showing us paintings that we don't know about, and we can learn from. And then, yes, it raises a lot of interesting questions about how Black painters fit into this colonialist, empire-driven ideal.
That's right. And of course, another thing that gives me hope, and also it seems to me connects to what you were saying about personal choices, is that when the Biden-Harris administration knew that it was going to be the presidency, there was Lorraine O'Grady's Artiz was used in that video that said, "We've won." And it was extraordinary that, an artwork by an African-American artist was used to transmit this message of unity that they want to project. It seems to me, again, that's setting an agenda for the future, right?
That's right. And they went out of their way to contact O'Grady and get permission from her, which is always a good sign, right? That and the list of speakers and singers at the inauguration. There was a COVID memorial ceremony that President Biden and Vice President Harris led the night before the inauguration. And two singers, one did Amazing Grace, one did Hallelujah. Both were Black women. At the inauguration itself, a lot of people I know from the art world were just bowled over by Amanda Gordon. She was the first National Youth Poet Laureate, and she was chosen to do the inaugural poem. And I have one line from her here that speaks to the question you asked about the painting too. One line from her poem, she said, "Because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we stepped into and how we repair it." She's talking about reparations. Maybe not financial reparations, but she's talking about reparations on the inauguration day. The fact that they included her gave her so much space. One of my kids said, "I think her speech is longer than Biden's." You know, her poem felt like a speech. It was speechified poetry. The fact that they were so inclusive in their choices for the inauguration celebrations.
Yeah, that's really significant, isn't it? Well, Jory, thank you very much. I think it's very much a question of watch this space. We're not going to know that much that soon, but it seems like we can be a bit more optimistic than we were about 4 years ago.
The art world that I know is celebrating. If it weren't for the pandemic, people would be dancing on the streets. But, you know, to what extent that affects the day-to-day of artists trying to make a living, yes, remains to be seen. Watch this space closely, as you said.
Jory, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
You can read our reports about the Biden inauguration, including the full Amanda Gorman poem and Art World Reactions, on the website or on the app. Coming up, we have QAnon's origin and obscure Italian conceptual art and Alphonse Mucha. But first, here are some of the top stories on the art newspaper's website this week. The New York-based dealer Hillel Namad, known as Heli Namad, received a pardon from President Trump in his final hours in office. In April 2014, Namad was sentenced to a year and a day in prison after pleading guilty to a federal gambling charge. He was released from prison after serving 5 months. Namad reportedly spent over $21 million buying the entire 51st floor of Trump Tower in New York. Museums that are currently closed due to coronavirus restrictions are doubling up as COVID-19 vaccine centres. Among the organisations involved are a number of UK museums, including the Science Museum in London. In Italy, the Castello di Rivoli Museum of Contemporary Art outside Turin will become the first gallery in the country to be used as a vaccine centre. And finally, a 16th century copy of Leonardo da Vinci's Salvator Mundi that was stolen from a basilica museum in Naples has been recovered by Italian police. Thought to be painted by a student of the Renaissance master, the painting was found during a police search in an apartment around 7 kilometres from the Museum di San Domenico Maggiore. The owner of the property, reported to be 36 years old by Agenzia Italia, has been taken into police custody under suspicion of receiving stolen goods. You can read these stories and more on the website or the app. We'll be back after this. The Week in Art is sponsored by Christie's. Christie's welcomes the new year with a series of online-only auctions, offering jewels, watches and fine art from the 15th century to the present day. Open now until the 28th of January, Old Master and British drawings, including property from the Cornelia Bessie estate, features one of Jean-Honoré Fragonard's most enchanting red chalk figure studies, Young Woman Dozing. Two of Albrecht Dürer's most spectacular engravings, Adam and Eve and Melancholia I, lead the exciting selection of rare prints available in Old Master Prints, also closing on the 28th of January. Discover designs by the most prestigious luxury houses, from Buccellati and Bulgari to Cartier and Patek Philippe, in jewels and watches online, La Dolce Vita, until the 3rd of February. Bidding for Mapping Modern and Contemporary Art ends on the 10th of February. Explore different Italian regions through post-war and impressionist artworks, alongside 20th century prints and photographs. The refreshed schedule complements Christie's private sales. Bid and buy art at any time and from anywhere. Find out more on christies.com. Welcome back. Before we go on, do make sure you catch up with the latest episodes of our other podcast, A Brush With, in-depth conversations with artists about their influences and cultural experiences. The latest series features interviews with, among others, Ragnar Kjartansson and Ronnie Horn, and the latest podcast is A Brush With the Danish artist Tal R. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're currently listening. Now, Joe Biden's inauguration destroyed a far-right conspiracy theory that had taken hold among Donald Trump supporters, the so-called QAnon conspiracy. QAnon followers had been promoting the 20th of January as the moment when Biden, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton and other elite so-called satanic paedophiles would be arrested and killed on the orders of Trump due to the actions of a crusading White House insider called Q. The disturbing effects of QAnon were visible amid the 6th of January riots in the US Capitol, when a fur-hatted, face-painted and bare-chested man called Jake Angeli, nicknamed in the media as the QAnon Shaman, was among the highest-profile rioters. So what's the connection with art? Well, it emerged a couple of years ago that QAnon may have been based on the activities of a collective of artists and theorists in Italy in the 1990s, a group known as the Luther Blissett Project. Eddie Frankel, the culture editor of Time Out and founder of the art and football magazine Oof, recently interviewed a member of the now-defunct Luther Blissett Project, and in the light of QAnon's disturbing presence among the Capitol riots, Eddie's written a report for the art newspaper on how the collective's activities may have influenced the QAnon conspiracy. I spoke to Eddie to find out more about this extraordinary story. Eddie, before we get on to QAnon, let's talk about Luther Blissett. Who are Luther Blissett, and why the hell are they named after a footballer who played for Watford in the 1980s?
So Luther Blissett is an amorphous and supposedly anonymous group of Italian artists from the 1990s. They started as a collective out of Bologna, and their main aim, back when they started in the 90s, was to do sort of media hoaxes and to perpetrate pranks, all of which were under the name Luther Blissett. That was the idea. And so it was a name that they didn't want to have control over. They wanted to be called Luther Blissett, and they wanted everyone else to be able to be called Luther Blissett as well. If you wanted to perpetrate a hoax, a prank, if you wanted to release an album, if you wanted to write a book under the name Luther Blissett, you were totally free to do so.
Can you give us some examples of the kind of hoaxes that they did?
Yeah, so they would do things like hold raves on trams. So they would go onto the trams in Bologna, they'd start a rave, and then when the police showed up and they got arrested, they'd say, "What is your name?" They'd say, "Luther Blissett." Every single person on the tram would say Luther Blissett. They would do radio shows, or they'd call into popular radio shows with really bizarre statements. And they said, "Who are we talking to here?" And they say, "It's Luther Blissett." One group of artists under the name Luther Blissett did a very odd prank where they went around the Alps trying to trace the word art as part of their journeys. In the same way as people these days can draw things on a GPS unit by cycling around town, they decided to walk through the Alps and spell the word art, but the artist who did it died in the Alps. Or did he?
Gotcha.
No one knows. Right. So essentially it's just this big prank, and so no one really knows what happened. It's just basically very, very playful psychogeography and pranks and just trying to spread disinformation for fun. So there's the core group who got known as the Luther Blissett Project. And that's sort of a more authorized version, if you will, of something that's not meant to be authorized. But the Luther Blissett Project was sort of hundreds of artists around Italy and Europe. And then the Luther Blissett name got used around the world. Thousands of things happened with it. Thousands of interventions, projects, albums, books, etc. And one of the big things that the Luther Blissett Project did was a group of five of them wrote a book called Q as Luther Blissett.
So tell us about Q, because it was published. Did it get picked up immediately? Was it reviewed? Was it something that became popular fiction immediately? Or was it a sort of a cult book?
It was a really popular book. So the idea behind Q, the novel, is it's a historical novel following a Protestant revolutionary in the 16th century. And he goes around Europe, sort of becoming part of revolts and revolutions across the continent. So essentially it's a historical novel, and it's written like you'd expect a historical novel to be. It's not a million miles away from Wolf Hall, except it's got very anarchistic intentions. This rebellious guy who's not really named in the book, going around being, you know, he meets Martin Luther and does all these things fighting against the Catholic Church. And the book was picked up pretty quickly, I think, and it was published in Italy and then translated around the world, including into English, into Russian, it's in Asia. It was a very, very popular book. Then Luther Blissett, after it was published, the group committed seppuku, so ritual suicide, in the late 90s. So they put an end to the Luther Blissett Project. And since then, the original group who wrote Q have gone on to be called Wu Ming, which is Chinese for no name, and they have written other books.
And you interviewed Wu Ming recently, right? So for your magazine Oof, which is a sort of football and art magazine, you interviewed Wu Ming in connection with this. And it was here that you sort of re-explored this idea that actually emerged in reports a couple of years ago about the link between Q, their book, and the QAnon phenomenon.
Yeah, so I was interested initially in Luther Blissett because they're named after an English footballer who played for Watford and Milan, and he was a bit of a failure when he came to Milan. And so I was interested in the idea that this group of Italian anarchists and artists and theorists would hold such an affinity for this very obscure English footballer. And the reason they liked him so much was because he symbolized trying and failing and then continuing to try. And so they were trying to reclaim the name, as I think in Italy, to Luther Blissett meant to miss a very easy goal opportunity. And they went, well, that's perfect for us. Let's take that. So I was interested in it from that perspective. And then over the course of my conversation with one of the Wu Ming, so they're all called Wu Ming 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Over the course of my conversation, Wu Ming 1 became quite animated when talking about Q and saying, you know, there are these incredible links between our book Q and the QAnon conspiracy theory, and he said it's been written about before. It got written about in 2018 in BuzzFeed, but the BuzzFeed one article sort of dismissed everything that Wu Ming said, and also didn't really use many of the quotes that they'd use. And so I was like, well, this is a great opportunity to print the full interview, and then that's what I adapted into the story with the help of Wu Ming One that got published in the Art newspaper.
So tell us then what those links are between Q and the QAnon phenomenon.
So the most basic links obviously are alphabetical. So in the book Q, there is a character who is, he's a Catholic Church insider. And everywhere that the main revolutionary character goes, the character of Q spreads disinformation to try and ruin the revolution. So he's a supposed papal insider who's got control of all this information. He writes to people, and via letters, he tries to undermine revolutions. That's his job. So he uses lies and disinformation to affect the course of history. That's the whole point of the book, about how a Catholic insider changes history with disinformation. And then in 2017, the QAnon conspiracy theory comes along, which involves a supposed White House insider, also called Q, who spreads what we would call disinformation, but what QAnon believers would say is the truth. And this Q insider, he or she or they are called Q because they have Q clearance at the White House, which means they've got very high level clearance. So they've got all this amazing insider information, which they start posting on the 4chan image board. And the information involves things like Hillary Clinton being part of a secret cabal of international paedophiles who are controlling the world out of a pizza shop. So to us, it sounds really ridiculous, but this thing has taken incredible hold in society, and it generally involves secret international paedophile sex traffickers who control the world.
And it's been sort of translated, hasn't it, from the kind of wars of religion of the 16th century that are reflected in the book Q into a really very, very unpleasant. It's basically deeply anti-Semitic, right, QAnon. It's the worst form of conspiracy theory. It directly relates to the white supremacist surge in under Trump, etc.
Yeah, it's a brutally racist, anti-Semitic, nasty conspiracy theory, and that's not that far away from what happens not only in the novel Q, but in Luther Blissett's strategies in general. The difference is that Luther Blissett's aims were they would perpetrate these hoaxes and these pranks, and then they would get people to believe them, and then they would expose the truth and go, you idiots, you believed this crazy stuff that we said. You listened to the media, you listened to us, you shouldn't have listened to us. So one of the great pranks that they did, which really shows the links with the QAnon movement, was... there's a huge wave of satanic panic that happened in the 90s. Across the world, there are all these stories about satanic groups that were abusing children all over Europe and America. And people were getting, it was like McCarthyism, but with Satanism and paedophilia. And so all these famous people were being accused of being Satanists who were abusing children. In Viterbo, this town outside of Rome, news came out that a group of Satanists were performing their black masses just in the forest on the outskirts of the town. And a group of Catholics decided to expose them. And so they went and filmed the black masses. So they showed all these people in black cloaks standing around, some nudity. They filmed them and then gave the evidence to the press. And so it ended up on primetime Italian news. So the Italian news is saying, look at this incredible story of these Satanists in Viterbo, and also there's these Catholic vigilantes who are stopping them. And then Luther Blissett came out and went, we made it all up. It was all total nonsense. The Satanists, fake. The Catholic vigilantes, fake. You guys are just believing in this ridiculous hoax. And so in the process, they're trying to say satanic panic is ridiculous. They're trying to say believing in these insane ideas is ridiculous. So they perpetrated a hoax and then exposed it. The difference is that QAnon perpetrate hoaxes, full stop. There's no exposing. So they let these ideas of satanic ritual abuse, of celebrity paedophile sex traffickers and cannibals, they let them take hold in society and then leave it. And so it's the same playbook that Luther Blissett used, except they're missing the bit that Luther Blissett found most important. So the links are there, the similarities are obvious. They're fairly direct. You can't say conclusively that QAnon took all of what it did from Luther Blissett, but it's pretty hard to ignore the links. And the difference is that QAnon are missing the bit that stops it from being a hateful endeavour.
Isn't the key thing that we're not quite sure who the middleman is, if you like? We're not quite sure what that very direct link is, in the sense that it's possible that someone in the spirit of Luther Blissett, with left-wing sympathies, thought, I'm going to send up all these crazy Trump people by doing something like what Luther Blissett did, but that sense of ownership and the sense of exposure didn't happen there, and it took hold. So in other words, it's, yes, the QAnon people have created a hoax, but somewhere in the middle of it, there's somebody who did something in the spirit of left-wing anarchist situationist people, and it just didn't emerged that it was all a send-up and a satire of the Trump supporters' ability to believe in conspiracies.
Totally. There's the very definite chance that this was a left-wing endeavour at the start, that people went, these Italians did this incredible thing. What we should do is something similar. We should start seeding these incredibly weird negative stories out into the world. And in the process, we'll expose how people will believe anything. And how ridiculous would it be if everyone started believing that there was a pizza parlor that where Hillary Clinton runs a paedophile ring? And it turns out they believed it, right? And it totally worked. And then they just left it. So even if their intentions were left-wing at the start, if they were anarchists at the start, if they were trying to mock Trump supporters, mock the idea that the older people on Facebook will believe anything you put out there, even if those were the original intentions, they've been completely lost in the process. And what you've ended up with is something that's just brutally, brutally hateful and racist and bigoted.
So you spoke to Wu Ming actually before the 6th of January, so before the worst manifestation of the QAnon thing happened, which was, you know, literally a QAnon shaman, that guy with the fur on his head and the horns and the spear sort of walking through the Capitol. And yet you did speak to them when they had seen the evidence that potentially what they had done had led to this terrible thing. Was there any sense of regret? How did they feel about it?
The best quote I got out of Wu Ming one when I asked him about this, because I said, you know, how would you feel as a dyed-in-the-wool anarchist lefty if the thing that you'd helped create went on to actually be something incredibly right-wing and powerfully hateful? And he said, well, how does Paul McCartney feel about the Manson family having used the lyrics to Helter Skelter? And he said, Paul McCartney still plays the song. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't mind. He obviously plays the song when he's on tour. He's quite happy with the legacy of it, because you can't control what people do with the things you make, which I think is, you know, a pretty pragmatic attitude to something that is now everywhere and in a very negative way. Because even before the events of January 6th, two people were elected to Congress, I believe, who were QAnon or former QAnon believers. The FBI had already listed QAnon as a hate group, as a domestic terror threat. So these things were, you know, January 6th was a real peak moment for QAnon, but everything had already been, the groundwork had already been laid out before that. So Wu Ming Wan saw what was happening and thought, I can't control this, but he does want to expose it, I think.
Ultimately, even if the effects might horrify Wu Ming Wan and everybody else involved with Luther Blissett, it does bear out everything that they were saying all those years ago. I mean, it reflects that the Luther Blissett Project was actually tremendously forward-thinking as an organisation, right?
Incredible. They, you know, they've become a slightly quirky footnote to sort of Italian art history. But what they did was actually amazing and impactful. And their work on group anonymity has had a huge impact on the way contemporary protests work. They worked on the white overall tactic, which was used in various protests, which was so that everyone sort of anonymized themselves as they were protesting. That came from Luther Blissett. And you look at some of the things that they did, and if they happened now, they'd still be incredibly avant-garde. And they're a pretty amazing group of artists.
Eddie, thanks so much for telling us about this extraordinary story.
Thank you.
You can read Eddie Frankel's article on QAnon and Luther Blissett at theartnewspaper.com, on the app, or in the next print edition of The Art Newspaper, which is out next week. Now for our work of the week. This time we look at the Slav Epic, a 20-painting cycle created by the Art Nouveau artist Alphonse Mucha over more than a decade in the early 20th century, given by him to the city of Prague. I spoke to the artist's grandson, John, about this vast series, its checkered past, and its now promising future. John, let's begin by talking about your grandfather. You didn't know him, is that right?
No, I didn't, because, in fact, when he married quite late in his life, and when my father was born, Alphonse was already in his 50s. So Alphonse died in 1939, and I was born after the war. So sadly, I didn't know him, no.
So were you as a child immediately aware that your grandfather had been a major artist and immediately kind of introduced to that extraordinary language of his?
I became immediately aware, and it was rubbed into my face and indeed the family, that Alphonse Mucha was a decadent, bourgeois, totally irrelevant artist for the great communist ideals of the working masses who were fighting the filthy capitalist regime.
So who was telling you that? Clearly not your dad.
No, well, in fact, right at the beginning, I only knew him when I was born And I was born in 48. In 1950, my father was falsely accused of espionage. The state prosecutor wanted death penalty, which fortunately he didn't get, but he was sentenced to 7 years hard labor in the uranium mines, which was not funny. And so I really started to getting to know him when he was released from jail, which was in the mid-1950s. Yeah, it was a strange period. Yeah.
Right. Now, as you say, Mucha's reputation suffered for a long period, but was sort of rehabilitated in the 60s. But should we set the scene about his work? And, you know, he was a great figure in the Art Nouveau period, for instance. But you can really divide his career into two halves. And we're going to talk about the second half, really, aren't we?
Well, he starts like all or most artists, you know, very poor, struggling. Then there's this extraordinary period where, or moment, where he designs a poster for Sarah Bernhardt, Gismonda, which in terms of style was literally like a lightning from blue sky, because that style didn't exist. And in fact, the French, who pronounce Mucha Micha, called it Le Style Micha, and only eventually it became Art Nouveau. So he becomes world famous. In fact, in a way, in 1905, he's a forerunner of the Beatles, in the sense that he arrives in New York and the New York Daily News, front page, the great decorative artist arrives in New York. So like the Beatles arrived, you know, at JFK, waving to everybody. But by that time, he's trying to create something, because he actually wasn't really very impressed with the Art Nouveau. I mean, it was, you know, incidental almost to him. And that's the beginning of the second phase, which finally ends with the Slav Epic, which is a creation of these 20 canvases. So, and stylistically, it's completely different to Art Nouveau.
And America's key to it, isn't it? Because there's a patron involved who's crucial to its commissioning.
No, he's in America, and in a way not quite, you know, making his way. But it's when he meets Charles Crane, who's a great Slavophile. And it is Charles Crane who helps him, who's inspired by Alphonse's vision, and so helps him to in the creation of this extraordinary work.
So let's talk about the work then. It's 20 canvases, and we're not just talking big canvases here, are we? I mean, they are utterly monumental, right?
To put it into perspective, and just in case if you have any art historians listening, you know, they might think, Christ, what's he saying? My background is that of an international banker, so finance. But obviously, when my father died, you know, what was going to happen next? And I took over, created with my mum the foundation. Why am I saying this? Because for me, the Slav epic, in a way, is the answer of the Slavs to Wagner in a different medium. And with the Slav epic, when it appeared, there were people who thought it was brilliant, and still today. And there are people who think it's not particularly brilliant. Which is exactly the same with Wagner's music. Some people adore it and some people don't like it. The other thing is, of course, Hitler misused Wagner. And when there was an exhibition of 12 canvases of a Slav epic at the Kunsthalle Krems in Austria, Zhirinovsky, who's a Russian fascist, was going to come and see, oh, the Slavs, big, big. And we were actually ready to completely debunk him. Because the Slav epic is, yes, it's using the platform of various periods in the Slav history, but actually its message, and I sometimes say, is yet to come. It is much more universal.
Can you say something about some of those themes then?
For me, and eventually I can give you also the evidence we have for that, as Alphonse is working over the years on Slav epic, so he's using the first 10 canvases are key historical points in the history of the Czechs and Moravians, which is part of the Czech Republic today. And the other 10 in the history of the Slavs, Russia, Bulgaria, Poland, and so on. And as he is working on it, what actually is coming out is that he's using that symbolism to focus on what I would call fundamental forces which move humanity and civilization wherever it happens to be. So it's not just the Slavs, right across today, in the past, and also in the future. And I think actually the Slav epic is very relevant to the future. I'll give you a specific example. One of the canvases is called After the Battle of Grunewald. It is a canvas which, quote unquote, celebrates the defeat of the Teutonic Knights by King Jagiellonski of Poland. Now he's standing there, and there are all these dead bodies. And yes, originally you could have interpreted, oh, we Slavs, you know, my goodness me, we socked it of them. No, he is standing there thinking how stupid the human race is, that it's got to sort out its problems through killing. And my evidence for it is that after the Slav epic, he was going to create a massive triptych, huge. I mean, Slav epic canvas is 6 meters by 8, but this was going to be much, much bigger. And the triptych, the only thing which exists are 3 small studies, because soon after that he dies, you know, the Nazis come in and so on. And the triptych is called the Age of Reason, the Age of Wisdom, and the Age of Love. And that, I think, is the fundamental distillation of his philosophy.
The ambition of the work was so extreme, wasn't it? Because he fully intended this to have its own building. So these 20 works would be housed in a bespoke space, and that was part of the sort of condition of giving it to Prague, right?
Yes, it was. And unfortunately, to this day, nothing specific has been done. What happened to it was that when the Nazis came in, they wanted to destroy it, and it was hidden away. And then after the communist coup, the first minister of culture, who himself actually was an artist, would you believe, he wanted to have it destroyed. But it was whisked away to Moravia, to a town called Moravsky Krumlov, which is very close to Ivančice, where Alphonse was born. And these people have looked after it until about 12 years ago, when it was taken away to Prague. And there's a sort of debate going on. I have been trying for years to enter into constructive dialogue with Prague. It was rather difficult. There is a legal action, but on the positive side, and very positive side, the latest situation is that, in fact, there is now a constructive atmosphere to do with City of Prague, partly generated, I think, by the fact that a Czech company has come in with a very interesting project, which in which an English architect, Tom Heatherwick, is involved with, and we are involved with. And the idea is that the Slav epic eventually, it's scheduled to go to Moravsky Krumlov this spring for a period of 5 years. But then after that, it will, by which time suitable space will be ready in the center of Prague. And the idea is that it won't be just the 20 canvases, it will be the 20 canvases, and we will put in all the material. So I always say, perhaps I'm sort of exaggerating, that the final creation will be a sort of equivalent of the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. It will be the whole story. So it won't be just, canvases, but there'll be oil studies, pastels, photographs, written material. And I think that should be very interesting.
And you couldn't have a better architect for these paintings in a way, could you? Because Heatherwick is famous for this rather florid style that he has.
He's lovely. I mean, we met him, and he said actually that he loves Mucha's work, which is also nice. Now I'm very excited. And I think the design that he and his team have created is wonderful. And I think the space and the design and the epic will work together very well. You know, it's like putting an orchestra together. So, yeah, no, I think it'll be very good.
So finally, these sonorous paintings will have their moment in the sun.
I hope so, yes, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us about them today.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
You can find out more about Mucha and the Slav Epic at muchafoundation.org. That's it for this episode. You can subscribe to The Art Newspaper at theartnewspaper.com. Click on the subscribe link at the top left of the page and you'll find a range of subscriptions. And do subscribe to this podcast and our other podcast, A Brush With, if you haven't already done so. And please give us a rating or review if you've enjoyed it. You can also find us on Twitter at Tan Audio and on Facebook and Instagram, of course. The Week in Art is produced by Julie Michalska, Amy Dawson and David Clack. And David also does the editing and sound design. Thanks to Jory, to Eddie, to John, and thank you for listening. See you next week. Bye for now. The Week in Art is sponsored by Christie's. Visit christies.com to find out more about the world's leading auction house since 1766. Auction, private sales, online, art, anytime.